We have only two more sermons in Leviticus left. Weeping, crying. Yes, it's been great. I've loved preaching through Leviticus. Last week, we looked at chapter 23 and the different feasts. Chapter 24 has a few miscellaneous laws, and then it has a story about an incident of blasphemy. I preached on that story a couple years ago on Sunday evening when I was working through the Ten Commandments. So we're going to skip over chapter 24. Chapter 27, the last chapter, is all about vows. And if you remember, way back when we talked about the guilt offering, we jumped ahead to chapter 27 and sort of took a quick look at that. So we're going to finish up with chapter 25 and chapter 26. This morning, then, Leviticus 25. This is one of the most famous, most confusing, most inspiring, most difficult to apply chapters in the whole book. It's about the year of Jubilee. The Liberty Bell. Famous Liberty Bell in Philadelphia, the one with the big crack in it, has one verse inscribed around the rim. And it's from this chapter. In the King James it says, "Proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof." Leviticus 25, verse 10. That's around the circumference of the Liberty Bell. This chapter, as that verse suggests, is about liberty, freedom, justice. The Liberty Bell, and this verse in particular, became one of the rallying cries of the abolitionists in the 19th century. And we'll see why. This is not a simple passage by any means, but I do have a simple outline. It's not a simple text. You can at least have a simple sermon. So here's what I want to do. First, I want to explain the text. Just walk through it. Explain what's going on, what these laws command. Second, I want to talk about why the step from exegesis, that's the word for interpreting Scripture, why the step from exegesis to application is so especially difficult with this passage. And then, third, I want to finish by venturing forth to suggest a few points of application, some timeless truths from this chapter. So first, we're going to walk through and explain the text. There are really three different sets of laws in this chapter. We have first some laws pertaining to the Sabbath year, then laws pertaining to the year of Jubilee as it relates to the land, and then laws about the year of Jubilee as it relates to the people. So Sabbath year, year of Jubilee, land, year of Jubilee, people. So it starts out with the Sabbath year, Leviticus 25, verse 1. The Lord spoke to Moses on Mount Sinai, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land that I give you, the land shall keep a Sabbath to the Lord. For 6 years you shall sow your field, and for 6 years you shall prune your vineyard and gather in its fruits. But in the seventh year there shall be a Sabbath of solemn rest for the Lord, a Sabbath to the Lord. You shall not sow your field or prune your vineyard. You shall not reap what grows of itself in your harvest or gather the grapes of your undressed vine. It shall be a year of solemn rest for the land. The Sabbath of the land shall provide food for you, for yourself and for your male and female slaves and for your hired servant and the sojourner who lives with you and for your cattle and for the wild animals that are in your land. All its yield shall be for food." This is the Sabbath year. The principle is very simple. Just like they were to take a rest one day in seven, so their land was to have rest one year in seven. This would have been good for the land to let it lie fallow for one year. Now they have the same sort of principle, but they get at it in different ways. Farmers will rotate crops to try to replenish different nutrients in the soil. They use fertilizer. There are different methods for keeping the carbon in the soil, but the principle is still the same, that the land needs to be replenished. Certain crops take a lot out of the land and the soil, and this would allow for the soil to be enriched So it was good for the land. It was also good for all those who worked the land. The landowners, the slaves, the servants, the animals. No planting, no sowing, no reaping, so you get a pretty good year off. And it would also have been good for the poor. Exodus 23, verse 10 says, "For 6 years you shall sow your land and gather in its yield, but the seventh year you shall let it rest and lie fallow, that the poor of your people may eat, and what they leave the beasts of the field may eat. You shall do likewise with your vineyard and with your olive orchard." So the seventh year, they figured, well, some stuff's just going to come up because there's still some seed that had fallen on the ground. And so whatever just sort of springs up on its own, you don't go and get that. But that will be for the poor. They can come in and take what they need in this seventh year. And if there's some left over, then let some of the wild beasts come in, some of the animals, and they can eat. Now, ironically, and perhaps not ironic, we maybe would guess this. This would have been a hard thing to do. Man, this would take a lot of faith. And the Lord promises here, if you look in verses 18 through 22, the Lord promises, look, I'm going to give you enough in the sixth year so that you'll have food in that seventh year. In fact, I'll give you enough so that then you'll have food in the eighth year all the way into the ninth year. Trust me. Just like that manna in the wilderness, I'll give you enough on the sixth day. Don't go out on the seventh day. But, you know, it's one thing for a day. Okay, Lord, I'll trust you. Well, it's, you know, I go hungry for a day. It's another thing for a whole year when the harvest comes around. No planting. Wow. You are really putting yourself out there. And so I say it's ironic because it seems that the Israelites probably never kept this. There's no evidence that they ever kept the year of Jubilee. It doesn't make it less the Lord's will for them, but there's no evidence that they ever kept the year of Jubilee, nor that they kept these Sabbath years. In fact, if you look over at Leviticus 26, verse 34, here we have blessings for obedience and punishment for disobedience. And one of the punishments, if they don't keep this Sabbath year, is that the Lord will force the land to have a Sabbath. Verse 34, "Then the land shall enjoy its Sabbaths as long as it lies desolate. While you are in your enemy's land, then the land shall rest and enjoy its Sabbaths. As long as it lies desolate, it shall have rest, the rest that it did not have on your Sabbaths when you were dwelling in it." And sure enough, 2 Chronicles 36, verse 20 says, "He took into exile in Babylon those who had escaped from the sword, and they became servants to him and to his sons until the establishment of the kingdom of Persia, to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land had enjoyed its Sabbath. All the days that it lay desolate, it kept Sabbath to fulfill 70 years." So one of the reasons, apparently, that they were sent into exile is because they had not given the land its Sabbath. And the Lord said, "You didn't do it. I'm going to make you do it by taking you out of the land. And for as many years as you neglected to give its Sabbath, I will make it desolate." Next, we come to the year of Jubilee. Verse 8, "You shall count 7 weeks of years, 7 times 7 years, so that the time of the 7 weeks of years shall give you 49 years. Then you shall sound the loud trumpet on the 10th day of the 7th month. On the Day of Atonement, you shall sound the trumpet throughout all your land." And here's the verse on the Liberty Bell. "And you shall consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you, when each of you shall return to his property, and each of you shall return to his clan. That 50th year shall be a jubilee for you. In it you shall neither sow nor reap what grows of itself, nor gather the grapes from the undressed vines, for it is a jubilee. It shall be holy to you. You may eat the produce of the field." So on the Day of Atonement, a trumpet blast. So on this holiest day in Israel, not only were the sins of a whole year wiped away and all their uncleanness for 12 months, but every 50 years, all of their financial ruin would be wiped away as well. And there were two components to this year of Jubilee. Return to your property and return to your clan or your people. That's why I said at the beginning, year of Jubilee as it pertains to land and it pertains to person. So you return to your property, you return to your clan. So verse 13, we have laws about returning to your land during this year of Jubilee. In this year of Jubilee, each of you shall return to his property. And if you make a sale to your neighbor or buy from your neighbor, you shall not wrong one another. You shall pay your neighbor according to the number of years after the Jubilee, and he shall sell to you according to the number of years for crops. If the years are many, you shall increase the price, and if the years are few, you shall reduce the price, for it is the number of the crops that he is selling to you. You shall not wrong one another, but you shall fear your God, for I am the Lord your God. This envisions the time when Israel would have its land, when it would enter into the promised land, and the Lord would parcel out that land for each of the tribes. Turn for just a moment to the book of Joshua, after Numbers and Deuteronomy. Turn to Joshua chapter 13. You can just see it here in some of the headings. For several chapters, the Lord assigns different parts of Israel to the different tribes. So halfway through chapter 13, there's the inheritance east of the Jordan, which goes to a few tribes. And then chapter 14, the inheritance west of the Jordan. You can look at chapter 15, the allotment for Judah. 16, the allotment for Ephraim and Manasseh. And on it goes all the way through chapter 21. Just to give you an example, look at chapter 17. Then allotment was made to the people of Manasseh, for he was the firstborn of Joseph. So that's one of the tribes. To Machir, the firstborn of Manasseh, the father of Gilead, was allotted Gilead and Bashan, because he was a man of war. And allotments were made to the rest of the people of Manasseh by their clans, Ebiezer, Helek, Esrael, Shechem, Hefer, and Shemaida. These were the male descendants of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, by their clans. You get the feel for it, all the way down. Not just tribes, but clans, family units. Here, you get this city, you get that city, you get that part as far as this boundary marker, as far as this river, this mountain. So it's all drawn up by the very hand of God. You can understand, just as an aside here, why Israeli-Palestinian issues become so heated when belief is this land came directly from God. Now, as I've said before, I said when we were going through Revelation, I think the Israeli-Palestine conflict, Christians need to approach it from a number of different angles. I think the one angle that probably is not the best way to approach it is the theological angle. I think the New Testament teaches that in rejecting their Messiah, that Israel has forfeited the covenant privileges. So you may come to different conclusions based on, well, what's good for the U.S. or what's good to support a democracy or whatever. Those are political, economic, military sort of decisions, and we may disagree on those. But I don't think you can come to a set decision just based on theology, because I think that this blessing of the land has not only been forfeited in the rejection of the Messiah as a theological right, it may be political, but as a theological right. But more than that, that the blessings get transposed, that now those who belong to Christ inherit these blessings. And it's not just inheriting the land, but Jesus says, blessed are the meek, they shall inherit the whole earth. So it's this cosmic end times sort of blessing. Close parentheses. So back here in Leviticus, here's how it would work. Everyone gets parceled off into their separate land, okay? You get Potter Park, you get Grosbeck, you get White Hills, okay? So you get different, you can have Mason. Everyone gets their different part of the land. But inevitably, some people over the years, things don't go so well. Maybe they're lazy. Maybe they're not very good at farming. Or maybe locusts destroyed their crops. Or maybe a plague came and wiped out half their family. Or robbers came. So maybe it was their fault, maybe it wasn't. But whatever the cause, families would get to their very end of the rope. And so they would have to sell off some of their land. What are they going to do? And so they'd sell off some of their land that God had given them to their neighbors. And the Lord is very careful here. He says there's a specific formula when you sell off your land. You calculate the price based on its proximity to the year of Jubilee. Actually, you don't technically sell the land, you lease it. Verse 23 says, "The land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine." And up in verse 16, it says, "You are selling for the number of crops." So what you're actually doing is leasing the land for the number of years remaining until the year of Jubilee. So suppose that the land went for, just pick an easy number, $100 per acre per year. Obviously, they're not using dollars, but $100 per acre per year. So if it's year 10 after the last Jubilee, that means there's 40 years until the next Jubilee. So the land would be sold slash leased for $4,000 an acre. $100 per acre per year. 100 times 40. So sell off this acre, all right, that's $4,000. If it's year 45 after the Jubilee, so you only have 5 years to go, then you would sell the land for $500 per acre. So you see what you're doing? You're essentially renting off the land for the remaining harvest left until the Jubilee. It's the price is fixed based on how close you are to this next year of redemption. Now look at verse 24. Here we have laws about redemption, how you get the land back. In all the country you possess, you shall allow a redemption. So you shall allow people to buy back the land. So they get poor, they have no other alternatives, they have to sell the land. Well, here's how you can buy it back. Here's what happens. Here's the best option, verse 25. You sell it to your family. You keep it within your family. If your brother becomes poor and sells part of his property, then his nearest redeemer shall come and redeem what his brother has sold. Remember this idea from the book of Ruth of a kinsman redeemer. Who's the closest family member who can step in and help you out when you're absolutely destitute? So it starts here, the family. That's the best option. The next option, verse 26. If a man has no one to redeem it, and then himself becomes prosperous and finds sufficient means to redeem it, let him calculate the years since he sold it and pay back the balance to the man to whom he sold it, and then return to his property. So, you sell the land, and then you get rich again, you get prosperous, you can buy your land back. And the one that you leased it to has to sell it back to you. And it's the same sort of formula. So go back to our example. You sell the land for $100 per acre per year. So you sold your land for $4,000 per acre because it was 40 years until the next Jubilee. But then say that 10 years later, you're back on your feet again and you want to buy your property back. Well, you have to buy back the balance of the years remaining. So 30 years are left. He's already paid for 40 years. He's only gotten 10 of it. So you need to pay back 30. In other words, $3,000 per acre to get the land back. There's always an option because you're essentially just leasing the land. You always have an option to buy it back. So the best option, keep it in the family. Next option, you get back on your feet and you buy it back. Last option, verse 28. If he has not sufficient means to recover it, then what he sold shall remain in the hand of the buyer until the year of Jubilee. In the Jubilee it shall be released, and he shall return to his property. So if all else fails, after 50 years, you're going to get it back. And then there's some special cases. Verses 29 through 30 talk about houses inside walled cities. You can buy back those houses for up to a year, but then after a year, it's gone, and you can't buy it back, and you don't get it back at the year of Jubilee. So you can actually sell and not get back your house if it's in a walled city. And then verse 31 talks about houses that are in a village that don't have walls. It says in verse 31, those houses are classified along with the fields. So you can buy them back. You do get them back at the year of Jubilee. So why this distinction between houses in walled cities and houses in villages? Well, it may be because houses in the walled cities would tend to change hands more often, or because they weren't considered part of the tribal inheritance, or possibly to guard against spies from taking up lodging in a fortified city. You don't want sort of spies coming in and buying this house up in the walled city, which would be the more precious cities. So for whatever reason, there's this distinction. And in verses 32 and 34, there's another exception. Levites can redeem their houses in the cities whenever they want, and they do get them back at the year of Jubilee. Remember, the Levites did not own any land. They did not get a land inheritance. What they got instead were 48 cities. Now, these would be very small little outposts for the most part, so don't think they're getting, you know, Lansing and Flint and Grand Rapids. They're getting just small little villages. They got 48 cities with some surrounding pasture land for their animals. So the exception for the Levites is because if they sold their houses in the cities and never got them back, they would be homeless for the rest of their lives because that's all they have. They don't have any land to get back. Now look at the year of Jubilee as it relates to persons. There is a progression here. I don't know if you've noticed it. If you're in financial trouble, the first thing you can do is sell off some land to some relatives. Have your family help you. If that's not an option, you can sell or lease your land to non-relatives. If that doesn't work, or you run out of land to sell, then you go to the next step, which is to get a loan. Verse 35, if your brother becomes poor and cannot maintain himself with you, you shall support him as though he were a stranger and a sojourner, and he shall live with you. Take no interest from him or profit, but fear your God that your brother may live beside you. You shall not lend him your money at interest, nor give him your food for profit. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan and to be your God. This text has generated a lot of discussion throughout the years. This is what is sometimes called usury, charging interest or sometimes defined as excessive interest on a loan. And because of this law and others like it, through most of Christendom, usury was prohibited. You couldn't charge interest on a loan. Now, here's one of the little strange but influential parts of history. Deuteronomy 23, verse 20, said that the Israelites could charge interest to a foreigner, but not to a brother. They can't charge interest to another Israelite, but to a foreigner they could. So what happened during most of Christendom and during the Middle Ages is you would have Christian magistrates or Christian kings who said, nobody can charge interest. Charging interest is not a Christian thing to do. But the Jews, who would not be subject to the laws of the church, said, the Jews, you can charge interest to foreigners. We're almost all Gentiles here. So they would hire or they would employ many of the Jews to be involved with banking and finances because they could charge interest. Sort of a sneaky thing that the Christians did, and it wasn't very good for the Jews in the long run. This is one of the things that has precipitated anti-Semitism over the years because you have, well, it's the Jews and the Jews only who are charging interest. Nobody else can, but they can. And so they often became despised in their communities. Now, During the Middle Ages, the church began to define usury more precisely. And the important distinction, and I think it's borne out here, is the distinction between loans of subsistence and loans of capital. So a loan of capital is to help you go build something or buy something or start a business. It's an investment. Somebody's giving you something and they get some interest back because of the risk that they're taking and giving you this loan so you can go out and start some new venture. That's a loan of capital versus a loan of subsistence, which is to simply allow people to continue to live. And that's the sort of loan that is always in view in the Old Testament. It's not a loan of capital, but a loan of subsistence. Interest on these loans were outlawed because it turned an opportunity for charity into an opportunity for profit that they would gain at the expense of someone else's misfortune. Aha, you're starving. You're dead broke. You have no food, no home, no land. Sure, I'll give you $1,000 at 18% interest. The Lord says, no, that's your brother. It's not an opportunity to make money because you know they're desperate, but to help them. And so no loans, no interest on those sort of loans. In fact, according to Deuteronomy 15, all the debts were to be forgiven every seventh year. So actually, when they were loaning to their brothers, their fellow Israelites, they should really think of every loan as a charity because, you know, maybe you'd get it back, but maybe the seventh year would come and all the debts would be released anyways. And Deuteronomy is very clear. You should not harden your heart because it's the sixth month of the sixth year and you figure, no way am I going to loan to this joker because in 6 months it's forgiven. It says, don't do it. You still give. The point is, if you have a friend or a brother in need, you help him. You don't try to make a buck off him. You loan him the money, interest-free. Give him what he needs. Don't be the guy or gal who's keeping track of every Big Mac that your friend owes you. Don't you owe me $3? Didn't you owe me? I don't know what your cutoff is. Mine's about 10, maybe 20. Maybe when you're young, it's like a quarter or something. But just relax. Let somebody buy you something. You'll buy it back, okay? Don't keep track of all the French fries. Just, I'll get the next one. Well, it's the same sort of principle on a larger scale here. Give freely. Don't fret about getting it back. You probably won't, but who knows? You may need it someday. So you get a loan, an interest-free loan from a brother or sister. The next step, okay? So there's this progression. And you've run out of land, you run out of money, you can't get a loan, or you've run out of that, then you can sell yourself to another Israelite, verses 39 through 46. The Israelites could get slaves from other nations, but they could not make fellow Israelites into slaves. Fellow Israelites could be indentured servants who needed to be treated kindly, and at the year of Jubilee, they would be released. The slaves from other nations would not. But their own people would. Well, if that doesn't work, here's the absolute last thing you can do. Verses 47 through 55. You can sell yourself to a stranger or a sojourner who is living among you. So you ran out of land, you ran out of money, you burned through your loan, you can't sell yourself to another Israelite, so finally you sell yourself to a stranger, to someone from another nation who's living among you. But there are still protections. You can be redeemed. You can be bought back at any time by a family member or if you save up money. And the redemption cost is calculated just like the price for redeeming the land. Okay? How many more years before the Jubilee? If there's fewer years to go, you pay less to get your freedom. If there's more years, you have to pay more to get your freedom. And if after 50 years, you're still an indentured servant, then you, along with all your children, shall be released in the year of Jubilee. It's So that's what's going on in this text. A lot of stuff. Now, why? Here's the second main point. Why is the step from exegesis to application so difficult? There's a lot of things you could rush to. Well, we ought to do this, this, this. Well, it's difficult to know exactly how to apply this for one simple reason, and then I'll explain it in some detail. The one simple reason is this. We are not ancient Israel. We are not an ancient agrarian society. Most of us don't deal with land or farming. Very few of us have walled cities. None of us, I think, deals with slaves or indentured servants. We could leave the fields fallow and let the poor go in and take some of the fruit in the seventh year, but that's probably not going to actually do much to help the poor. Most of the poor aren't out around to go and walk through the fields. Land also is not our chief source of capital. It's still an important source, but some of the richest people in this country may live in a penthouse up in Manhattan and have next to no land and yet be fabulously wealthy, while a farmer in South Dakota might have thousands of acres and have a very modest living. And freeing slaves and returning land to its original owners, it's a different world than the one we live in. So it's hard to get a feel for that. Perhaps most importantly, why this is difficult to apply is because our land was not parceled out directly by the voice of God. This is the real sticking point for trying to apply the year of Jubilee directly. Because if we said, okay, everyone gets to go back to their original landowners. Well, does that start now? Or is it 100 years ago? Is it 1776? Is it 1492? How far back do we go? Because it's not that God has spoken from heaven and said, the DeYoung family shall have Grosbeck. And I'm very kind to let some of you live there. No. The year of Jubilee makes sense when it is seen in the context of the Holy Land, that this land was a gift to Israel. He wanted his people to have it. He wanted the original tribes and clans to keep their original inheritance. So yes, the year of Jubilee was about helping the poor. We'll come back to that. But it was also about the perpetuity of the original land allotments. That God wanted the land to stay within the tribes. And it wasn't given out equally. Some of the tribes had more land, better land. Some had less. The Levites had none. The firstborn son got double from the other sons. It's also difficult because our economy is not based chiefly on a fixed piece of land. And because of that, the pie of wealth doesn't have to be fixed either. See, in Israel and much of the ancient world, if someone got rich, it was almost always because someone else had gotten poorer. Especially in Israel, you have, this is your land, boom, boom, fixed. So if you have more land, it means someone else has lost some of their land. You're richer, they're poorer. In a modern economy, wealth can be created, which isn't to say that the rich never exploit the poor. That certainly happens. But it is possible for the rich to get richer and the poor also to get richer. Which, over the last two centuries, has happened in almost every country, that the lifespan is longer, the per capita GDP is greater, and even though there are still tragic levels of poverty and hunger, which should concern every Christian, our nation is not under the Mosaic Covenant. We aren't promised miraculous harvests in the sixth year. The blessings and the curses in Leviticus 23 aren't directly for America. We are not God's chosen country. And most of us are not Jews. So how do we apply these laws when they distinguish so carefully between Israelites and foreigners? Because if you think about it, the year of Jubilee was very good news for the Israelites, especially the poor. But it didn't do anything to help the non-Israelites. In fact, if you were a stranger or a sojourner who moved into Israel, you became prosperous, you bought land, you had servants who were Israelites. At year 50, you have nothing. You lose all of that. So how would we apply this distinction between Israelites and non-Israelites? Would we make it between legal citizens and non-legal residents, between people of our own country, people outside our country, between Christians and non-Christians? All of those distinctions are problematic. So all that to say, I wrestled a lot with what to say about this. That seems to be a fair application from the text. So let me finish by giving you five statements that I think can be defended from the text and will hopefully help to speak to our situation. Number one, we should find ways to give opportunities for the poor to succeed. Not only does this text say don't be ruthless to the poor, don't take advantage of the weak. More than that, the year of Jubilee teaches us to look for ways to give fresh opportunities. Now, some of you might say, well, if we do things for the poor, we give them stuff, we're just going to enable them. We're going to help them to continue to make bad choices or squander their money. And it's true, we want to be smart in how we give and what we give. But listen, I would rather have 10 people who have a heart that breaks for the poor and yearns to do something to help them and may need a little learning when it comes to how to do it or economics or whatever. I'd rather have 10 of those people than 10 people who are really smart and understand economics and don't really care much for people. I'd rather have the first 10. I'd rather have good intentions, good theory, but I'd rather start with the first 10 who say, we got to do something. We got to help people. And then we figure out the best way to do it. So we have to be smart. And the great thing about these Jubilee laws is it didn't just give a lump sum of cash to poor people. What it did is it helped give them opportunity. It gave them access to capital, to land. Not everyone may deserve a handout, but everyone needs the opportunities that make self-sufficiency at least possible. And that's what at least landed. It made self-sufficiency at least possible. The year of Jubilee didn't guarantee that the poor wouldn't be poor a year later and they'd have to wait 49 more years to get another crack at it. But what it did do was give the poor another opportunity to make something of themselves. So we need to be smart. We need to be thoughtful. We need both kinds of gifts. We need, you know, oftentimes in churches, you got people talking past each other. And you got these people who are they got a heart for the poor, for social justice, and they're passionate. Then you got people who know how to do business and grow companies and sell things. And sometimes these people, they assume the worst about each other. They don't like each other. Well, you bleeding hearts and you're just helping people don't deserve it, or you're capitalist pigs or whatever. We need both people to figure out how to do some smart things. I just want to read real quickly. This is a book. Bob, did you guys read through this book a while back by Robert Lupton? And you call yourself a Christian toward responsible charity. He works with the Christian Community Development Association. And I just really like this little book because there's all sorts of wisdom that I don't have because I'm not on the ground level doing it like he has for a long time. And there's a story in here I thought was very telling. It's a few paragraphs. Just listen to it. It just talks about how we give opportunities in a way that uses both sets of gifts and is also smart. He says, there was a need in the community for decent, affordable clothing. And so a network of affluent churches got together for this ministry. And a vacant neighborhood church was reopened. It had a large unused storage room that seemed the perfect place for a community clothing closet. As soon as the first customers came through the door, however, the spirit of charity that smiling volunteers exuded faded. And so rules had to be hastily enacted because customers would come in and they'd grab and growl and stuff as many clothes into a trash bag as they could carry. And so they made a rule, 3 garments per visit, 1 visit per week. And he says, we thought this would be the modicum of order, but it was like saying, let the games begin. Customers probe to find the limits and the loopholes of these rapidly conceived regulations. Could they get 3 articles of clothing for each of their children who are in school? Could they get 3 garments for their sick uncle? An adversarial relationship soon developed between those in charge and those in need. In no time at all, our volunteers were behaving like the temple police, guarding the resources of the kingdom against the very people we intended to serve. There's a simple solution to that problem, we were informed by a Methodist men's group from one of our supporting Atlanta churches. It's called the market. If we put a fair rate of exchange on a desired commodity, they counseled, it would eliminate the hoarding. Sell the clothes. Don't give them away. People will then buy only what they can afford, and if they have no clothing money, they can work in the store and earn what they need. And this would produce cash flow and would enable us to hire unemployed residents and train them in merchandising and help propel them into the economic mainstream. And so the men's group agreed to take this on as their annual missions project. And they set about to do the things that business types do. They studied real estate and traffic flow patterns. They decided the store would have to be on a bus line and have state-of-the-art cash register, have an advertising plan. A full-time manager with retail experience was needed to run the operation. And if we did it right, the store should break even within 24 months. These men understood business. We understood urban ministry. And he says the plan worked better than we had projected. 18 months from opening day, the store moved into the black and became a self-sustaining operation. We hired and trained unemployed community residents who were able to move into full-time jobs in the marketplace. The store's atmosphere was warm and inviting, a place customers felt good about coming to. And there was a change in attitude between the staff and the community. Customers were valued because they sensed they were needed. They were welcomed, not as objects of pity, but as essential customers. The store could not survive without them. The experience revealed that people, perhaps universally, would far rather engage in legitimate exchange than be the object of another's pity. And I just love that story because people got a heart, people got some skills, and they figure out what's the best way that we can actually help people. And it does take quite a bit more effort than just giving things away, but it's much more sustainable. And Lupton has a very realistic approach to these sorts of issues. He says you need outside energy and resources to help revitalize a city or a neighborhood. But he says, more importantly, you need good neighbors because they're more effective than good programs and they're cheaper. And he said, in the long run, you need economic viability if you're to really revitalize a neighborhood. So the year of Jubilee teaches us to look for ways to give the poor opportunities to succeed. Well, let's move through these others more quickly. Second, I think the year of Jubilee teaches that the Bible supports the existence of private property. The land here is owned not by the state, but by individuals and families, clans, tribes. It's actually a very absolute property right. God himself says, this is your land, unless you break the covenant. And that permanence of landholding would serve as an encouragement to develop, to take initiative. This is one of the brilliant things about the ownership of private property, is it enables us to be little creators in the image of our Maker and to cultivate something and help it develop and prosper. So it supports the existence of private property. Third, the year of Jubilee also relativizes private property. Verse 23 says clearly, the land is mine. Unless we think this is just about the promised land, you'll remember Psalm 24, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. So God owns the land, and the year of Jubilee helped to remind the people that they were not going to get the big prize in this life. Verse 23 says, they were strangers and sojourners. Just like the New Testament says, we are exiles and aliens looking for a country that is to come. It's one of the brilliant things about the year of Jubilee. If you have to give back all the land you accumulate once every 50 years, you're going to sort of not put all your eggs in that basket. And is our life really that much different? Think about it. You have to give it all back every 70 years or 80 years. Some of you, fewer than 50. So what are we living for? This Jubilee attitude can give us patience when things don't go well for us. And it can give us trust that God knows what He's doing because He owns it. You imagine if you were house-sitting for a very wealthy person. It was very generous. It said, come and you can stay in our house rent-free. And you know what? Eat whatever you want in the fridge. Use the two cars in the garage. Go use the boat. Here's the credit cards. And then one day, 2 years later, the owner calls back and says, I'd like to let another friend of mine use the boat. Well, some kind of friend you are. Remember, you don't own any of it. He's letting you use it in the first place. That's how we should think about our stuff. This isn't ours, God. Thanks. We get to stay in your world. That's nice. And if you want some other people to use our stuff, then that'll be good. Fourth, Jubilee teaches that our God is the God of second chances. I think a text like Leviticus 25 would support some of our modern bankruptcy laws that allow people not to get completely destitute, start over. It would support the existence of a social safety net. We could debate how much of that should be from the state, but certainly a safety net provided by the family and by the covenant community. The Jubilee saw to it that everyone got one clean start in their life, one second chance. And that theme just gets transposed to a new key in the New Testament, a spiritual key. Think about Jesus' parable of the unforgiving servant who had been forgiven so much and refused to forgive what little was owed him. Jesus takes this Jubilee principle and he says, I'm a God, not just once in your life, over and over again, I give you a fresh start. Will you give others the same fresh start? Or do you still look at that guy? That's that guy that was into pornography. That's that girl who said that about me. I remember that's the mother who treated me that way. My father who never played ball with me. Our God gives second chances. And last, Jesus is Jubilee. Jesus is Jubilee. Listen to what Jesus says in Luke's Gospel. As Jesus came to Nazareth, where He had been brought up, as was His custom, He went to the synagogue on the Sabbath day and stood up and read. And the scroll of the prophet Isaiah was given to Him. He unrolled the scroll and found the place where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon Me, because He has anointed Me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent Me to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." And He rolled up the scroll and gave it back to the attendant and sat down. And the eyes of all in the synagogue were fixed on Him. And He began to say to them, "Today, this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing." Now that's some chutzpah. I'm Jubilee. Right here. This day of the Lord you've been waiting for, Isaiah 61. It just sat down in your midst. Jesus says, in effect, I am good news for the poor because I can meet their needs. And I am also good news for the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. I am good news for the captives because I can set them free. And I am good news for those in spiritual bondage because I can be their deliverer. I am good news for the physically blind because I can restore their sight. And I am also good news for the spiritually blind because I will open their eyes to see the glory of God. I am good news for the oppressed because I hear their cries for justice. And I am good news for the spiritually oppressed because I can conquer sin, self, and Satan. You ever go through a day and think, what a waste of a day? I have a number of days like that. What did I do today? Why did I waste my time? What kind of person was I? You ever have a week like that? You ever have a year? What was I thinking in 08? Man, just had my head screwed on. You ever have a life like that? What was I doing? Man, I'd like to just start over. Jesus says, all right, you can. You don't have anything against me. Nothing. No debts. You don't have to be in my indentured servant. No loans to repay for me. No servitude to make up. You have nothing but original innocence. Nothing but freedom. Nothing but new opportunities to obey. Today, Jesus says, today can be your jubilee. And tomorrow. And next year. And whenever you need it. Let's pray. Father, we come needy, broken sinners. Release us, free us, forgive us through Jesus. Amen.
Please stand for our closing song.
Thousand tongues to sing my great Redeemer's praise, the glories of my God and King, the triumphs of His grace. My gracious Master and my God assists me to proclaim, the spread through all the earth abroad, the honors of Your name. The name of Jesus charms our fears and bids our sorrows cease. His music in the sinner's ears is life and health and peace. He breaks the power of canceled sin. He sets the prisoner free. His blood can make the foulest clean. His blood avails for me. He speaks and listening to His voice, to death the deadly seed. The mortal broken heart rejoice, the humble poor believe. Hear Him, you deaf, you voiceless ones, your loosened tongues employ. You blind, behold, your Savior comes, and leap you lame for joy. To God all praise and honor now and ever give. My saints below and saints above, now a church in earth and heaven.
The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make His face shine upon you and be gracious unto you.